dictators ride to and fro upon tigers, which they dare not dismount, and the tigers are getting hungry. Sir Winston Churchill.
So this is how liberty dies. With thunderous applause.
Welcome to Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause. I'm your host, Scott, with Uncle Ian, as always. Today's matchup features two North African dictators, Muammar Gaddafi against Hosni Mubarak. Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause is a history podcast obsessed with history's biggest dictators. We've created a knockout competition to determine the single biggest dictator of all time. Each episode features a matchup of two dictators where we discuss the life and times of each leader. The loser of each battle is eliminated from the tournament. The winner remains in the contest to be named history's biggest dictator. Up first, Muammar Gaddafi, the mad dog of the Middle East.
His neighbour Anwar Sadat called him the crazy Libyan.
He was the dictator of Libya from 1969 to 2011. He put Libya on the map and he became a household name. He thrived off attention and notoriety. So what made Gaddafi so infamous? Here we go. Gaddafi was a member of the semi-nomadic clan and born in a tent in Italian-occupied Libya. Libya is a large North African country between Egypt and Algeria. It was historically inhabited by the Berbers and it was ruled by the Greeks, the Carthaginians, and the Romans. It was colonized by the Arabs in the 600s, converting the region to Islam and making Arabic the dominant language. It was later ruled by the Ottomans and then the Italians from 1911 until just after the Second World War, when it became an independent country. Gaddafi as a child was intelligent and emotionally unstable. He was possessed of a mythical sense of destiny at an early age, and like many dictators, like Mussolini, Stalin, Saddam Hussein, he was expelled from school. The Egyptian colonel Nasser became Gaddafi's idol after Nasser overthrew King Farouk and took the Suez Canal off the British. Gaddafi came to believe in the formation of a pan-Arab state. He joined the army purely as a means of overthrowing the Libyan monarchy. He cleverly enrolled in the Benghazi Military Academy, where he recruited potential revolutionaries hostile to the king. On September 1, 1969, Gaddafi staged a coup. They occupied airports, police depots, radio stations, and government offices in Tripoli and Benghazi in Libya. The king was away on holidays, so he had the prince arrested instead. At the age of 27, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi was the ruler of Libya. I'm a little bit embarrassed here, Uncle Ian, because I certainly wasn't ruling an oil-rich nation when I was 27.
I think you're probably on firmer social and economic ground by running your own business.
It's probably for the best. His official title was not president or king, but the brotherly leader and guide of the revolution. Gaddafi even changed the country's name to the Socialist People's Libyan Arab Jamhuriya. When some members of the military staged a coup against him, it was quickly crushed. His idol, Colonel Nasser of Egypt, died the following year, and Gaddafi declared himself the leader and custodian of Arabism. He believed communism and capitalism had failed and published his infamous Green Book in three parts from 1975, outlining his political philosophy of Islamic socialism and direct democracy. Direct democracy in practice meant no democracy, as he believed a representative democracy is really a guised dictatorship. He said, "There is no state with a democracy except Libya on the whole planet." It was a bestseller, the book. All of Libya had a copy because they feared the consequences if they were caught without one. It's a very interesting read. Here's a few quotes. "It is an undisputed fact that both man and woman are human beings. According to gynecologists, women menstruate every month or so." He's so wise, Uncle Ian. Well, this man, we're so lucky to have him.
He must have had a whole stable of research assistants.
Another one I like is, the grandstands of public athletic fields are actually constructed to obstruct access to the fields. But my favorite quote, mandatory education is a coercive education that suppresses freedom. To impose specific teaching materials is a dictatorial act. That's my favorite quote, because under Gaddafi, schools were mandated to spend 2 hours a week teaching the Green Book to children. And they had to read that sentence in class where he's railing against forced propaganda in schools.
He's not the first dictator to publish his own book and make it a bestseller, though.
No.
Scott, Chairman Mao and the Little Red Book, for example.
And Saddam with his erotic novels.
Yes, that's true. And of course, there's a German dictator we haven't met yet who became the writer of a bestseller as well.
Do the Germans have dictators too?
Yes, we haven't yet got to Germany, but at some stage during the podcast we will.
So despite Gaddafi's delusions of a utopian pan-Arab Jamhuriyah, he ran Libya in a manner typical of Arab dictators, brutal authoritarianism with corruption and tribal favoritism. The discovery of oil in Libya brought billions to the country each year, but his Arab socialism utopia produced food scarcity, riots, and market stampedes that trampled shoppers. Cinemas, music concerts, and football crowds were all banned. Living in Libya sounds a bit like living in COVID.
So, Scott, in terms of mentioning football and sport, we don't think a lot about Libya when we think about international sport. But in fact, there is a great legacy. In the early 1980s, when the Australian cricket team was playing in Pakistan, in the city of Lahore, the ground on which they played is called Gaddafi Stadium. I originally thought it was a coincidence, but it turns out it's not a coincidence. The Pakistani government in 1974 was allied with Libya. Gaddafi was strong in support of Pakistan's right to pursue nuclear weapons, and in recognition of that, the Pakistan government renamed the major cricket stadium in Lahore to be Gaddafi Stadium, and it's still called that today.
That's fantastic. We're in an age where they keep changing the names of every public building they can think of. Surely Gaddafi Stadium can get a name change. Musical instruments were said to be Western imperialism and were burned in Tripoli. Books were taken by police from bookshops. Book burning is classic dictatorship. 10 points to Gaddafi. Gaddafi also dictated when traitors are discovered in a tribe, the Libyan people automatically consider the whole tribe guilty and the people's committees have the right to shoot them dead. Collective guilt? Another 10 points to Gaddafi. In 1996, Gaddafi's brother-in-law arranged a massacre in the Abu Salim prison in Tripoli, in which guards are said to have gone from cell to cell with Kalashnikovs and grenades, killing 1,200 inmates. Murder and violence of political enemies was widespread. One former guard recalled witnessing the murder of 17 students, saying, "We were not allowed to scream. We were made to cheer and shout, to act as though we were delighted by this display. Inside, I was crying. They shot them all, one by one." Gaddafi even kept some of his victims in freezers and enjoyed visiting them as souvenirs and symbols of his power. So Gaddafi was a very strange character, incredibly strange. His wardrobe has been described as monstrous. It would vary from pastel blue military uniforms with 16 medals, of course, to a mustard-coloured African garb with Louis Vuitton sunglasses, and then also an all-purple suit with a matching purple shirt. As you can guess, he was incredibly vain. He once said, "Those who do not love me do not deserve to live." He had plastic surgeons flown in from Brazil to rejuvenate his appearance. Unfortunately, he didn't get his boobs done, which is a shame because I think he'd look good with a set of bolt-ons. The operations were conducted without a general anaesthetic because he was paranoid someone would kill him and replace him while he was unconscious. Uncle Ian, I reckon if you're that paranoid, you probably know you're doing a bad job.
And what was going on with the hair?
Oh, the hair's not great. It was like a perm sort of thing.
Yeah, it was a sort of a cross between a mop and a straw broom, but I don't think it would have worked as either.
Gaddafi's outsized ego led him to relish foreign visits, which were very unusual. He brought an entourage of 400 people in four aeroplanes. Most heads of state check into a fancy hotel. Gaddafi brought with him a gigantic tent, which travelled in its own plane. He pitched this tent in public parks, on the grounds of five-star hotels, outside the Kremlin in Moscow, beside a 17th century villa in Rome, or in one instance, in 2009, on Donald Trump's property in New York. At home, he had zebra skins and leopard pelts alongside a solid gold lounge in the shape of a mermaid sculptured to look like his daughter. Creepy. He had a collection of golden guns like a Bond villain. He also had the greatest liquor collection in all of Libya. Why do you think that is, Uncle Ian?
Was he the only one allowed to collect liquor?
That's exactly right. Liquor in Libya is banned for everyone except Colonel Gaddafi. He had a beautiful all-female troop of bodyguards. In Europe, they were known as the Amazons, and in North Africa, they were admiringly dubbed Haris al-Has, the private guards. He used them to inflate his own egotistical fantasy as an accomplished and desirable man, the powerful and handsome leader of Africa and the Arabs. And I'm so annoyed because this should be funny, but of course, like everything else, Gaddafi has to ruin it. The reality was, the female guards were made up of his favourite rape victims. Hundreds of teenage girls were abducted and taken to soundproof cellars for him to rape. At Tripoli University, there was an examination room where Gaddafi's chosen victims would be tested for STDs before being sent to him. Victims would be dumped on the street or simply disappear with her families left searching for them. Otherwise, the victims would be passed on to his sons and eventually to high officials. Gaddafi also raped young boys. These boys were taken and imprisoned, becoming child sex slaves. They were euphemistically called the Services Group. But it was Gaddafi's international acts that made him famous. He kicked the Jews and Italians out of Libya on October 7, 1970. This day was an annual holiday called the Day of Revenge. Gaddafi confiscated all Italian property, estimated at 400 billion lire. He forced the Italians on their way out to dig up their dead relatives and take them to Italy. He also gave explosives to various terrorist groups, the Palestinian terrorists, the ANC and the IRA. He killed and kidnapped political dissidents overseas who had fled Libya to Egypt and even in Europe. He had a very strained relationship with Europe, once saying, "We have 50 million Muslims in Europe. There are signs that Allah will grant Islam a victory in Europe without swords, without guns, without conquests. We will turn it into a Muslim continent within a few decades." It's exactly what Erdogan said. He also organized terrorist attacks on Europe, including shooting at protesters in London from the Libyan embassy. In 1986, American President Ronald Reagan had had enough and bombed Tripoli and Benghazi. Gaddafi survived and realized Libyans would actually welcome his death. He resolved to rejuvenate his image. He commandeered a bulldozer and broke down the walls of a prison compound containing his political prisoners. The Europe attacks stopped and he began to speak in friendlier terms of the West. He allowed greater free market trading, which brought in necessary goods to the country. The reversal eased the suffering that his own policies had created, and his image became to improve at home and abroad. Then he made a cataclysmic error. Uncle Ian, can you please tell us about Flight 103?
In 1988, a Pan Am flight exploded over Scotland, over a town called Lockerbie. The death toll was 270. That was 259 people on board and 11 people on the ground. British intelligence were able to identify that there had been a Libyan plot to place a bomb on that plane. It took years, but eventually Gaddafi offered up the terrorists for trial and admitted that it had been a Libyan plot and paid compensation to the families of the victims. But as an atrocity, it was unprecedented, but also, I think, quite unnecessary. It did actually more damage to Libya than it did trying to reinforce any strongman image that he wanted to portray.
By complying to the terms, the sanctions were lifted. And this led to the third transformation in Gaddafi's fantastical international orientation. He pronounced, "Arab nationalism and Arab unity have gone forever. May God keep the Arabs away from us. We do not want anything more to do with them." He turned to another continent instead, saying, "Libya is an African country." he announced his new vision, a United States of Africa, with Sirte, his hometown, as its capital, and himself as its self-anointed King of Kings. This event predates smartphones, but if there was a group chat with all the Africans in it, it's safe to say that Gaddafi's message will be left on scene.
He followed the African dictator playbook in so many ways, but one thing he was determined was that he would remain in his standard military rank. So he was always a colonel. He didn't promote himself to general, field marshal, admiral of the fleet. He wanted to remain one of the people.
Oh.
So by continuing to call himself a colonel, he could continue to justify that title.
With his collection of golden guns and mermaid-shaped golden loungers, I don't know if he succeeded in that desire to appear as one of the people. In 2009, he gave his first speech to the United Nations General Assembly. He was supposed to speak for 15 minutes, but it went for over an hour. And at one point, he teared up a copy of the UN Charter and compared the UN Security Council to Al-Qaeda. Really not playing to the crowd there. By 2011, it had been 42 years. Gaddafi was the longest ruling non-royal leader in the world. Then, on January 4th, 2011, one man changed the world. Mohamed Bouazizi, a street vendor in the neighbouring country of Tunisia. He was frustrated at the harassment he was receiving from the country's corrupt police officers. Unemployment was rampant, so he was forced to sell goods on the street. The police would often bully him and demand bribes. He went to the local governor's office to complain, but he was denied a meeting. Later that day, outside the governor's office, he set himself on fire. His self-immolation triggered widespread protests in Tunisia against their own dictator, His Excellency Zine El Abidine bin Ali, who was removed within 2 weeks. The Arab Spring had begun, and it spread to Egypt, to Syria, and to Libya. The self-immolation of Mohamed Bouazizi triggered civil wars on two continents and a migrant crisis on a third, provoking Britain's exit from the European Union. However, unlike the leader of Tunisia, Gaddafi was not willing to concede to protesters in Libya. When he learned that protesters were organizing online, he said, "I'm not such a dictator that I would shut down Facebook. I'll merely imprison anyone who logs into it." He turned tanks, artillery, and weapons on civilians, killing and injuring thousands. He appeared on television and warned of rivers of blood and gave the choice of submission or liquidation and war until the last man and the last bullet. He launched a counter-offensive to reimpose his sway over the capital and retake areas lost in the east. NATO responded by implementing a no-fly zone to prevent this massacre. The protesters stole weapons from the military bases and became an armed rebellion. The people of Libya were now at war with Gaddafi. Some within the military defected or refused to fight for him, and after 6 months, the rebels took control of Tripoli. Gaddafi was found hiding in a drain in his hometown of Sirte. He was later sodomized and shot and killed. After Gaddafi, Libya is now a mess of tribal conflict. Elections were held, but not everyone was happy with the result. Islamists rebelled against the new elected government, taking over Tripoli and unleashing civil war. The militia groups established to fight Gaddafi refused to disarm. This was worsened by the Libyan government policy to pay militias to compensate them for their involvement in the revolution. All this did was provide ongoing funding for violent militia groups. Libya was now paying militias to kill each other. So as a result of the scheme, the number of such groups rose from 300 to 1,400. The UK, Italy, and Turkey all sent advisors and training personnel to establish a genuine Libyan police force. All projects failed. Slaves were sold in the street. There's been over 10,000 people killed since Gaddafi's death. The old government refused to recognize the recent elections. Libya is currently divided between its warring groups. You've got a UN-backed Tripoli-based government controls the west, a Tobruk-based government controls the east, and ISIS controls a portion of the north, and nomadic indigenous groups control the southwest. Uncle Ian, what does it say about a country that life gets even worse without a psycho like Gaddafi there?
It shows how short-term Gaddafi's influence turned out to be. It also shows, I think, the truth of the obituary in the Times newspaper, which said about him that he squandered his country's oil revenues on weaponry, international terrorism, and grandiose projects, and went on to describe him as eccentric, narcissistic, and murderously unpredictable. And even for the Times, that's pretty strong.
I suppose this goes beyond our scope. Was it a mistake to help the revolutionaries in the way that Obama and Hillary Clinton bombed and enabled the revolution to happen?
Yeah, the US, despite what they'd claim would be good intentions, we've found in plenty of episodes, Scott, that the US doesn't have a good record at picking winners. And whether that should actually be the US's role is a very big philosophical question that's probably an episode all on its own. In recent years, should the US have been intervening? Again, it comes down to motives. You just don't know what. Were the motives genuine about saving lives? Were the motives about regime change? Is a stable loony better than anarchy? I don't know. And whether Gaddafi, in if nothing else, providing stability, is better than what they've had in the last 10 years, it's still too early to tell. A lot of this goes back as far as the early 70s, when Henry Kissinger was National Security Advisor in the Nixon administration. Nixon was worried about the new Libyan leader, but once Kissinger said to Nixon that it's okay because his Revolutionary Command Council, at last a title that actually means what it says, the Revolutionary Command Council was anti-communist. So Nixon was happy with that and decided that at that stage they didn't need to intervene.
Up against Muammar Gaddafi, we have the Egyptian dictator, Hosni Mubarak. Uncle Ian, please tell us about Mubarak.
Mohammed Hosni El-Sayed Mubarak, born on the 4th of May, 1928, in the Manufia Governorate, which is in the Nile River Delta. Egypt became independent in 1922. In 1956, Nasser became the second president. He closed the Suez Canal. And we've just recently seen that's a great way to get world attention, is to close the Suez Canal.
He didn't even have to shut it. He could have just parked a ship diagonally in the middle of it.
In 1970... Anwar Sadat became the third president. The late 60s and early 70s were dominated by war with Israel. So Mubarak had originally enrolled in army officer training in his early 20s. He moved to the Air Force Academy, went to the Soviet Union to learn how to fly bombers, became a pilot officer and a flight instructor, and by 1972 he was chief commander of the Air Force. That put him in a prime position to lead the campaign against Israel in the 1973 war, and that won him national acclaim.
Mubarak was involved in the 1973 war, but he's accused of stealing the credit for the Air Force's success in that war. He allegedly, photographs pertaining to the discussions in the military command were altered, and the military chief of staff was erased from the photo and replaced with Mubarak.
So, Scott, that means that while he was in the Soviet Union learning how to fly bombers, he was also learning how to use Photoshop.
The Soviets love a bit of Photoshop, don't they? That's fantastic.
The successful campaign against Israel increased Mubarak's national profile, and in 1975, Sadat appointed him. Keyword there is appointed. It's not an elected role, it's an appointed role. Appointed him to be vice president of Egypt. By the late 70s, Sadat was ready to make peace with Israel, and that treaty was signed in 1979. Egypt was kicked out of the Arab League for making peace with Israel. Just gives you an idea of how strong the anti-Israel feeling was. Up to this point, we've got no evidence that Mubarak ever had any ambition to become president of Egypt. That all changed on the 6th of October 1981. While at a parade, ironically, on the anniversary of the 1973 war, Islamic extremists among the military assassinated Sadat while he was reviewing that parade. There's strong evidence that those extremists was sponsored by the dictator of neighbouring Libya.
Gaddafi strikes again.
They opposed the treaty with Israel, so wanted to take revenge on Sadat for that treaty. Mubarak was alongside Sadat. He was wounded, but not seriously. Interestingly, reports of the assassination say that the shooters had taken the drug hashish, which was in fact a tradition. The Arabic word for hashish eater is assassin. Egypt subsequently held a national referendum to succeed Sadat. Mubarak received 98% of the vote. It may not surprise you, Scott, to find out that he was the only candidate.
Yeah, that helps. Or they had the old one candidate, but with two options, yes or no. And one reporter even recalled seeing piles of ballots with a yes tick and said the yes ballots had the exact same tick with the exact same stroke with the exact same pencil in the exact same way.
Maybe all the Egyptians learned handwriting at the same place at the same time. Because of Mubarak's profile in the region, Egypt was able to rejoin the Arab League. Mubarak started by arresting hundreds of Islamic extremists who were supposedly involved in the assassination, and he released a number of the political prisoners that had been locked up under Sadat's regime. So he was off to a reasonable start. In 1987, he was elected for a second six-year term. In 1990, Iraq invaded Kuwait. The US was asked by Saudi Arabia to remove the Iraqi troops from Kuwait. Mubarak supported Saudi Arabia, committed 40,000 troops to the first Gulf War. The reward was billions of dollars per annum in US military and economic aid, forgiveness of $10 billion in foreign debt. The price was that many expatriate Egyptians lost their jobs in Iraq, which meant that they weren't bringing in the foreign exchange to the country. Whether that was going to be made up for by the military and economic aid, in the short term, yes. In the longer term, perhaps not so. In 1993, Mubarak supported negotiations for the agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinian Liberation Organization. That helped maintain his good standing with the US. But it was about the same time that Mubarak was quoted as saying that the Egyptians could not handle democracy. Unrest continued to grow. There was increased guerrilla violence, and opposition parties were brave enough to be pressing for electoral reform. He continued to campaign against Islamic fundamentalists, especially after jihadist troops carried out a string of attacks on foreign tourists within Egypt. This helped reinforce his reputation as what the Washington Post called a bulwark against Islamist extremism. It's estimated that in the mid-1990s, 30,000 people were thrown in jail.
It didn't help that the Islamic extremists kept trying to kill him. He survived six assassination attempts, and so really rubbed him the wrong way.
You're allowed to take that personally. By the mid-90s, Mubarak was feeling a bit threatened. The enactment of a law restricting publication of any anti-government news was a strong turning point. Prior to that, the press had been freer than under Nasser or under Sadat. In 1999, he was elected to a fourth term, again unopposed. The amount of money that saves on ballot papers and pencils and those cardboard electoral booths, Scott.
And people having to count.
And the post-election telecast lost a little bit of dramatic effect. With the help of his two sons, the family was able to accumulate a sizable fortune during his 30 years in power, estimated at £50 billion, getting up towards $100 billion Australian dollars. I can't even comprehend that amount of money. As insurance, some £300 million were stashed into Swiss bank accounts. You just never know when you're going to need your Swiss bank account. This wasn't really Mubarak being paid for performance. By the early 2000s, the official unemployment rate in Egypt was nearly 10%. The rural poverty rate was 40%. In 2010, the United Nations Children's Fund determined that 23% of children under the age of 15 were living in poverty. And the World Economic Forum, when ranking the quality of the primary education system, out of 133 countries worldwide, Egypt was ranked 124th. That's an appalling indictment of Mubarak's reign.
You're right, he's definitely not being paid per performance. He needs a little performance clause in the contract.
Yeah, they might have left that schedule off the referendum in 1981. Amnesty International tells us that the State Security Investigations Agency, again, another title that actually says what it means, thankfully, had over 100,000 employees. And during the Second Gulf War in the early 2000s, Egypt wasn't a combatant, but did provide support to the US, including supporting the rendition and torture programs undertaken by the CIA. Scott, do I need to say allegedly in that sentence?
Well, it depends on whether you enjoy the euphemism enhanced interrogation techniques.
So if you're listening on behalf of the CIA, please imagine that I said the word allegedly before the word torture. In 2005, Egypt held its first multi-candidate elections in more than 50 years, primarily due to US pressure. Despite the low voter turnout and despite Mubarak's advanced age, he was 77, he was elected. This became his fifth term. In January 2011, the Arab Spring came to Egypt, and the protesters were able to harness social media in order to spread their message and to arrange their protests. Mubarak did make some concessions. He was going to implement social and economic reforms, which was apparently the first time he'd considered doing so in his 29 years in power. Promised to lift the emergency law, which had been in place since Sadat's assassination in 1981. So for all of that time, Egypt had been under what we'd call either a state of emergency or martial law for the entire regime. Mubarak acknowledged that he wouldn't contest the presidential election due in September.
But if he doesn't contest, there's no one on the ballot.
It does mean they can't reuse the ballot papers from the earlier elections, that's true. He also appointed a vice president. This was the first time he'd done so. Chillingly, the vice president that he chose was the director of the intelligence services.
Never a good sign. Never a good sign.
All this is happening in January 2011. On the 31st of January, the army announced it would not use force against the demonstrators. That was a massive turning point in Mubarak's regime. On the 11th of February, Vice President Suleiman announced that Mubarak was stepping down. We don't actually know if Mubarak knew that he was stepping down until he saw it on television. But by then, it was a fait accompli. During the 18 days of upheaval, there were some 900 protesters killed and 6,000 injured. Mubarak would be charged with making no effort to prevent the loss of life during the protests. Interestingly, Suleiman would be quoted as saying that Egypt is not ready for democracy. It's a bit of a theme there, Scott, and I have a strong feeling that the current ruler of Egypt probably feels the same way at the time of recording this episode. Perhaps reassuringly, Mubarak is one of the very few dictators who ended up going on trial. He was found guilty of complicity in the deaths of demonstrators. He was, however, acquitted on charges of corruption. Our older listeners, Scott, might remember that Mubarak was wheeled into court on a hospital bed.
He then died on the 25th of February, 2020. Following the elections, the Muslim Brotherhood candidate Mohamed Morsi was elected president in 2012. The Muslim Brotherhood is an Islamist organization that works to impose Islam over society and establish Sharia law. The army, being quite secular, wasn't happy with this and staged a coup the following year. As a result, the president has reverted to another military strongman.
There is one concession to democracy, Scott. General Sisi, an authoritarian military leader, was elected in 2014. He had to face the polls again in 2018, so they're down to 4-year terms. Yeah. And we'll be watching the 2022 election very closely.
How legitimate was the election?
In 2018, the majority by which Sisi was re-elected was 97%.
Oh, okay.
I wonder if they're still using those same ballot papers.
They've crossed out Mubarak's name and replaced it with Sisi.
So, Scott, you know I love a good obituary quote. The New York Times, while saying that he never intended to be president, did summarise by saying that it was hard to know what he stood for, apart from retaining power. Amnesty International said that the signature policies of Mubarak's rule, namely mass torture and arbitrary detention, remain a daily reality in Egypt, and that his legacy lives on through the tools of repression he created. I think we get the idea of how Mubarak was seen on the international stage.
When the Egyptians had a genuine attempt at a vote, they elected the Muslim Brotherhood, and that would impose Sharia law over their fellow Egyptians. Are they not ready for democracy? Secular rule, where everyone gets along and the different religions live side by side, is that something that's impossible? Not yet possible?
It's the old trade-off, Scott, between having security and stability on one hand, unless you're one of the targeted few, and having freedom on the other, and risking the anarchy that we've seen in so many other parts of the Middle East in recent years. I think what we're learning from North Africa is that if you are going to make a transition to a democratic state, that takes a long time, and the foundation is a good education system.
The Arab Spring seems prematurely named, given it wasn't a resounding success. Why did they call it that?
It actually dates back to the 1960s, the use of the term Spring as a people's revolutionary movement. In January 1968, there was a brief period of liberalisation in Czechoslovakia, at that stage still behind the Iron Curtain. There was the announcement of press freedom, guarantees of civil rights and liberties. That Prague Spring lasted for 7 months. In August, the Soviet tanks rolled in, just as they had in Budapest.
Those pesky Soviets. It's time for us to decide a winner, who's going to go through the next round and who's going to be eliminated from the tournament. Mubarak does a great job of being a North African dictator, but Gaddafi really has that X factor of wearing stupid, crazy clothes, the tent that he's parking in Paris and in...
Outside the Kremlin, Scott.
Outside the Kremlin. He's, oh, geez, that's a dangerous location. And obviously the medals. Anyone who's wearing 16 medals is going to go through the next round, really. So I'm going to give this one to Gaddafi, Uncle Ian.
Yeah, I have to agree. What we've learned about Mubarak was power for its own sake. Whereas if we were playing dictator bingo, then Gaddafi's ticking boxes all the way through.
Let's go dictator bingo. So, medals.
Tick.
He's written his own manifesto.
Oh, tick.
Fake elections.
Tick. Moving the capital city to your birthplace. That's an oldie but a goodie.
Mass torture, mass rape, mass killing.
Tick. Trying to be a player on the world stage. I think he was overreaching himself. In that respect, and you mentioned what Reagan called him, the mad dog of the Middle East.
Yeah, excellent.
For Reagan to give him that name when he wasn't a communist is pretty strong.
Yeah, and there's a few contenders in that area. All righty, congratulations to Muammar Gaddafi. You've made it through to the next round.
I think that's pretty comprehensive. We don't need to rig that election.
No, he's heard this one. All right, next time on Liberty Dies with thunderous applause. Uncle Ian, where are we going?
Oh, Scott, I've been looking forward to this one. We're going to ancient Rome, and we're going to meet two well-known names from the first century. We're going to look at Caligula, and we're going to look at Nero.
Oh, the best. Oh, very much looking forward to that, Uncle Ian. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Scott.
See you then.